A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, and welcome to Whispers from the Heart, a mini-series of conversations about our relationships with the world's greatest animation studio, Studio Ghibli. I'm Michael Leader.
And I'm Steph Watts, and we've seen the lot of them.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I've been howling for more.
So join us on our quest into the glorious world of Ghibli. And we're back. It's Michael Leader here, talking as always with Jake Cunningham.
Hello.
And Steph Watts.
Hi.
So this is a bit of a different thing for us, isn't it? A new sort of mini-series called... I can't take credit for the title. I think, Steph, you came up with it, didn't you?
Yeah, I can't remember. I definitely floated the idea all aboard the chat bus, which I think was swiftly rebuked, but Whispers from the Heart is lovely, no matter who came up with it.
I think it's just so wholesome and really gets the vibe of what we're going to be doing with this mini-series, which is talking with fellow travellers through the world of Studio Ghibli, some of whom are animators, some of whom worked for Ghibli, writers as well. It's going to be such a nice, cosy mini-series, I think, now that the nights are getting longer and the cold is drawing in.
And we're going to be starting this series talking about a studio that maybe has the most direct comparisons to Ghibli out there in the current market. Would you say that's fair?
Cartoon Saloon, I think so, yeah. So it's become a bit of a cliche to refer to them as the Irish Studio Ghibli, or to refer to Tom Moore, one of our interviews today, as the Miyazaki of Kilkenny. But it is true. Their films have a similar balance between storytelling, environmental themes, and experimentation, but also the sense that they focus, well, they do TV animation and shorts too, but their focus on the feature film as a major statement does put them in the similar, I think definitely the similar leagues to Ghibli, but also in similar conversations too.
And for me, a Cartoon Saloon film, Song of the Sea, was one that I saw in cinemas before I'd seen any Ghibli in cinemas as well. So in my own kind of awkward chronology of watching all of these things, I knew their work on the big screen before I knew Ghibli's.
Mm-hmm. Steph, did you know Cartoon Saloon's work, or are you relatively new to them?
Not really. I mean, I'd heard of them, but Wolfwalkers is the first one from Cartoon Saloon that I've seen, and I loved it, so I definitely need to go back and kind of delve into all of their earlier works.
I think this is a great opportunity to do that, because Wolfwalkers is, I mean, as we speak, it's in UK cinemas, but it will be coming to Apple TV Plus for Christmas in December. But this seems to be getting a bigger push than all their films so far. And it's so great when that happens, when you know that they have three previous films in the chamber that people can go and discover. They've been innovating and excelling over the last 10 years, decade or so, from The Secret of Kells, Song of the Sea, as you mentioned, Jake, and then The Breadwinner. These films that are released by G-Kids in the States, most of which released by Studio Canal over here in the UK, they do get into Oscar contention and conversation. They do get festival releases. So, an absolutely brilliant body of work. We should say that we are talking to the co-directors of Wolfwalkers today. That is Tom Moore, one of the co-founders of the studio, but also Ross Stewart, who previously worked as concept artist and art director on a few of Cartoon Saloon's work, as well as actually concept art on Paranorman, the Leica Studios film, which is another studio that sometimes gets talked about in similar conversations with Ghibli and Cartoon Saloon. But Ross is co-directing this one. But what I love about Cartoon Saloon is that, unlike Ghibli, and I think we mentioned this in the conversation, they're much more collegiate in spirit. Across our conversations about Ghibli, we've said how there's been this tension between the generations, between Hayao Miyazaki and everyone else, in terms of who gets to have control, directorial control over the films. But what's great about Cartoon Saloon is they do have co-directors. They also have directors who are rising through the ranks. Nora Toomey, who directed The Breadwinner, is also working on a film that's coming out next year, I believe. I can't wait to see that. So it's great to be able to talk to two people from Cartoon Saloon at the same time.
So here is our conversation with Ross Stewart and Tom Moore.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
So I'm not sure how much John gave you in terms of context for what we do.
Yeah, I actually realized I'd listened to some of your stuff before about Mononoke and stuff. So.
Oh, fab. Yeah. Oh, great. Thank you for listening. No surprise then. We are a Ghibli focused podcast, even though our tastes do range quite broad beyond that.
I like podcasts, I listen to them a lot when I'm working. It's been a while, but when I would be working on something that I could just get immersed in, I would always look for interesting podcasts. And I remember there was a period where I was looking for Ghibli stuff and I came across you guys.
It's the benefit of being one of the only ones we can say we're the world's best.
Oh, yeah. We always say we're the best animation studio in Kilkenny. And now we've got another studio in Kilkenny. We're like, damn.
Cool. So, please excuse us if we're going to talk a bit about Ghibli up top. This will be going in a mini-series that we've put together where we're talking to, directors, filmmakers, writers who all have some sort of personal connection to Ghibli, and we sort of talk about that and maybe the influence that we see in their work that we love.
We're Ghibli fans. I was just saying to John that you'll be impressed. I have a layout drawing by Miyazaki on my mug. It's shining too much, but I went to a exhibition of Takahata and Miyazaki's layout drawings in Paris, because they do a lot of the layout posing themselves, especially Miyazaki. And I got a mug of his layout posing of that scene where Ashitaka is shooting the arrow.
Very cool. So should we kick off, Jake, with the first?
Yeah, I think we're 2 minutes in and we've been out nerded already. let's actually do an official start, shall we?
Yeah, so Tom Moore, Ross Stewart, thank you so much for joining us for this episode today. So first question, let's head this off at the pass. Cartoon Saloon, referred to as the Irish Ghibli one too many times. Maybe it doesn't get old, maybe it's becoming a bit of a cliche for you now. But I'd really like to ask what your personal relationships are with Ghibli. Are you fans?
Yeah, I'm a big fan for a long time, but I came kind of late to the party. I wasn't aware of them as a kid, and I wish I'd seen their movies as a kid. I discovered them as an animation student, and then over the years became more and more in love with the themes, the stuff that they explored in their films, and felt a kinship that way, you know.
Yeah, I think when we were younger, we didn't really have much access to like to anime and to stuff basically outside of like mainstream comics and mainstream films. But yeah, it was, when we got to animation college, we were able to explore a lot more. And yeah, as Tom was saying, I just often wonder what I would have made of some of the stories as a kid if I'd seen them back in like the 80s, you know.
Well, that's actually one of the themes of the conversations that Jake and I've had over the years with the podcast, is that, you know, I'm of the age where I was just just the perfect age to, as a teenager, becoming of age when Spirited Away was the one that got the big international push. Mm. And also managed to get Princess Mononoke in Chinatown in Manchester on a dodgy Region 3 DVD before that.
Wow.
But that really changed everything, and it must have been so such an eye-opener to see those films at that time.
When I was in college, I'd been reading Japanese manga in a kind of reprint comic called Manga Mania, and I knew of, like, you know, Akira and things like that. But it was only until I was in university or in studying animation that there was a lot of buzz about Mononoke was going to be distributed by Harvey Weinstein, ironically. But I remember that was kind of, people were saying this is going to be the breakthrough. I don't know if it was the breakthrough people were talking about, animation fans, but at the time the Disney movies were, like, you know, the high point of the hand-drawn Disney movies in the late 90s and the beginning of Pixar and everything. So I remember coming into my consciousness pretty late and expecting it to be much more schlocky and being impressed by just how spiritual it was, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So what was the first one you saw? Would that have been Mononoke or Spirited Away?
It was Mononoke.
It was Spirited Away for me as well, yeah. But I just remember how utterly bizarre they were, like, you know, just especially with Spirited Away, just like the lengths that they could go to, like how utterly surreal some of the characters and some of the events. Yeah. And I was just thinking, like, even at the time, you know, like as a kid, it might have actually blown my mind and caused some mental illness. But as an adult, I was just going, wow, this is like the most trippy stuff you could ever imagine.
But then can you speak, Tom, to that sense of the spiritualism that you found, the spirituality you found in these films? Because that's something that is reflected, I think, in the Cartoon Saloon films that we know and love, is this sense of something deeper going on.
Yeah, it was interesting as well, because I didn't know if it, like, my son was pretty young at the time, and he was maybe like 8 or 9 when he first watched Mononoke. And I remember watching it with him. And of course, he was drawn in by the action adventure. But we had some really great discussions about the aspect of it that really showed the worldview of nature and man, and the fact that he was able to find this kind of middle ground to be sympathetic towards Lady Eboshi, like the way she treated the prostitutes and the lepers was really humane, but the way she treated the animals was so, like, destructive. And I thought it led to some, like, much deeper than something like Pocahontas or Fern Gully that had a similar sort of, you know, man versus nature thing going on, but so much more simplistic than Mononoke. Mononoke was so, and then just technically, I mean, Mononoke technically was just one of the high points of hand-drawn animation. Like, it's like nothing else.
Our assistant director is still talks about watching Princess Mononoke frame by frame, the entire film.
he shares an apartment with the head of digital. Yeah. Digital ink and paint, and they're both nerdy enough that they sit and analyze it frame by frame.
Yeah, but I think for him, just to figure out how they actually pulled off some of the shots, because for Tom myself doing Wolfwalkers anyway, we left a lot of that technical stuff to him, you know, like how to arrange like camera moves on layouts and everything. So his in-depth analysis of Mononoke definitely helped.
And is this kind of technical aspect of it, the actual making of the animation, that Michael and I just have no insight into? And so I'd love to ask both you, when you're watching a Ghibli, other than the story, the themes that are in there, what are you looking at in the animation that is so inspiring?
Well, what happened for me was I was at Toronto International Film Festival promoting Song of the Sea at the exact same time that Takahata was there with Princess Kaguya, and I hadn't seen anything of Kaguya prior to this. And I'd been doing these interviews and saying, oh, hand-drawn animation can do so much more than it's been allowed to do, and it can be much more expressive and everything. And then I went to the Winter Garden Theatre and watched Kaigua and had my, you know, my ass kicked, because I just was amazed how much he was, how bravely he was allowing the animators' drawings to be up there on the big screen. And from a technical point of view, how deftly he was mixing like CG effects with very hand-drawn effects, and just the fact that he was brave enough to not cover up the artifacts of the creation of the drawings was really inspiring for me. So I think all the other ones I felt were like one of the, it's not a negative, but for me, I'd be much more experimental in my approach. And I always felt that Miyazaki kind of found a style, and he tells a story with that style, and he pushes the limits within that style, but he doesn't go too far away one direction or another, whereas Takahata's stuff seemed to just go all over the map in terms of like visual, like art direction. And he can go all the way to kind of almost super realistic in Only Yesterday, and then all the way to like super cartoony in the Yamadas. And then for Kaigua, he kind of went really expressive and dramatic. So I always was so impressed with his range, you know.
I think technically for me, it's the level of detail and level of artistry that goes into every frame. I mean, like, we tend to simplify our characters and simplify our backgrounds as much as we can, because we know how many hours go into like every single person on the team working on it. I just don't know how those people that work in those films sleep or find time to sleep or eat. There's so much work that goes into it. It's incredible.
When we were making Song of the Sea, and we were looking at Ponyo, and I was saying, oh, imagine we could animate the sea like that. And it was just like, no, we can't. That's not humanly possible. But they did. Yeah, but they're Japanese. They can do it. We can't animate the waves like that.
There really is something in the water over there, isn't there?
It's sad, because I've been over there and talked to some of the animators there, and I think they have this whole structure of that we've totally lost in Western animation, of kind of master and apprentice stuff, and that they're always trying to like prove themselves, and they have this like zen-like approach to like detail, as Ross says, and the kind of one-upmanship of like how perfectly they can draw everything. And I mean, to me, it is a big ask of any artist to do work at that level. And when I read Miyazaki's Turning Point, his autobiography, I was like, I wouldn't like to work for him. Like when I was young, I used to think, oh, what a dream to work for an amazing director like that. But I think it would be a tough ask, because what he demands of his artists is just phenomenal. Animating the grass blowing in the wind. Like, come on, man.
But you do see those photos of, like, you know, people sleeping on the floor in subway stations and stuff from overworking and that, so you can kind of understand it.
Under their desks, yeah, that's the thing. Oh, man.
So have you met anyone from Ghibli, Tom? Yeah. You said you went over to Japan. Have you met anyone over there? Did you meet Takahata or Miyazaki?
Yeah, I have two anecdotes from both. And they were both acting in the States, because it was always around the Oscars. So I was at the Governor's Award when John Lasseter was given Miyazaki a Lifetime Achievement Award, like a Governor's Award. And it was cool to be at that. And then I don't smoke, but my producing partner, Paul, smokes cigarettes. So when I saw Miyazaki out having a cigarette, I borrowed a cigarette off Paul and went out and pretended to smoke just so I could hang out with him. And he was mightily amused. Through a translator, he was amused by the fact that I was coughing and spluttering over a cigarette. And he said, oh, you can have my ashtray and stuff. So it was a very minor, like, that was the interaction. And I said, it's also that thing, like, what do you say? Like, I was just like, oh, thanks for your films, they're great. And then Takahata was very warm. Again, it was all through a translator, but I hung out with him a little bit more because we were on the same press junket with Song of the Sea and Kaigua. And he had a younger guy who spoke good English with his producer, who's since gone on and set up Ponok. And we kind of got to know them a little bit more. But at this stage, Takahata was kind of old. And I remember the funniest thing was that we were all sitting there sweating and nervous when our category was going to come up for the Oscars. And I turned around to see him, and, like, you know, all the other directors were like, and he was asleep. And I just loved the fact that he was like, what the fuck, I don't give a shit about it. He was asleep at the Oscars. And it was like our category. And he was asleep. I thought it was kind of amazing and awesome. But he was very warm. He was a really nice guy. And he kind of took his time with us. I felt like he was kind of avuncular, grandfatherly about it. You know, he kind of felt, he knew his position as a kind of legend of animation. And I think that tour with Kaigua was kind of a swan song, you know. So he was very nice to meet at that point in his career. think he was be another person who would have been quite, you know, formidable if I'd met him when he was younger and he, we were in some kind of competition. I think he was pretty.
Well, I'd love to bring this into your work that you're doing at Cartoon Saloon and watching Wolfwalkers and thinking about what we might see in Ghibli films as well. There's such a strong connection to folklore in there that is still accessible to any audience, and we might watch My Neighbor Totoro or Pompoko or The Tale of the Princess Kaguya, and we don't know the centuries background of those stories, but they absolutely still connect with everyone. And I'd love to kind of ask you how you transpose those traditional stories into making something that is still accessible to everyone.
Yeah, Ghibli is always the best example, I think, of that, that you get a taste of Japanese culture and lifestyle and folklore, and that kind of Shinto animist worldview is kind of transfused, but yet everyone can watch them, and you don't need to go and learn about Japanese. It's interesting to see what's pure invention on the part of the directors and what's but it's just, you can watch the movie, because I think it's about the emotional resonance. Like, you try and dig into the folklore and find what's the aspect of it that you want to draw out to tell your story, and I think that's what speaks to everyone. So with Song of the Sea and the whole Selkie story, the kind of direction that I kind of wanted to explore was the ideas of loss, and I think that's super universal. And then when we were looking at this, we really wanted to talk about the independence and wildness that was represented by the wolves and the ability to exist in both worlds at once. Like, Ross and I talked a lot about how we're not actually separate from nature, we're part of nature, and that this folklore tales where animals and humans could be either and both at the same time, that was the aspect that we wanted to draw out. So I think you find the universal theme that speaks to folklore all over the world and people all over the world, and then that's the thing you focus on to make sure that everybody can relate to it, and then all the other stuff just becomes part of the flavor that makes it more individual and more interesting and not generic, you know.
Yeah, and I think if you find out about the folklore along with the character, along with the main character, you know, that they're going on a journey of exploration the same time as the audience, then it makes them much more accessible. So like, Robin doesn't know about Wolfwalkers at the start of the movie, and as she finds out about it, we find out about it, you know, so it immediately becomes much more accessible. And then, as Tom was saying, if it's a universal there's a universal theme to it, so that anyone in any other culture can follow the story of friendship and of this little girl being trapped. And it's almost like the folklore part of it takes a backstage, you know, that it's kind of like an environment in which she has a personal meeting and a personal friendship.
And you mentioned admiring the artifacts of animation being left on screen in The Tale of Princess Kaguya. And that is something that is really evident in Wolfwalkers, and it looks beautiful. What was the thinking behind leaving those shapes on screen that people can see how these forms have come together?
It's definitely evident in Maeve and the wolves and the wild animals, and I think the reason for that was to show that there's like an inner life and an inner spirit to these characters, very different from the townspeople who are cleaned up like with a very precise kind of hard, ink, woodcut kind of print style. So like the roughness and the scratchiness of the forest animals kind of shows this instinctive wildness that they have, that they live under, and it shows that underneath the surface there's this huge energy there, you know. So I think visually there's a huge contrast between the two worlds. But I think also we wanted to show how much art goes into the making of these cartoons, that those scratchy lines and form lines used to be erased, and then you'd be left with a perfect clean line. And like, they're beautiful. The original sketches that animators would use to explore and to develop the forms are actually beautiful in their own right. So, you know, why not leave them on the screen? And it used to be done a little bit more back in, maybe by accident, but back in the times of like 101 Dalmatians and that, when the artifacts might be left over and they might actually make it to the cell through the Xerox process. But there was a certain charm to that we always loved. And so this time we kind of did it intentionally.
Yeah, we're trying to make a virtue of the fact that we're working in hand-drawn, you know, draw attention to the fact that it's hand-drawn and celebrate the fact that it's hand-drawn. Like, I always like to see Nick Park's thumbprints on Wallace and Gromit, you know. It's just nice to see. And we even had sections like the Wolf Vision that were all on paper. And even if it was all based on a CG previs, the final thing is all drawn on paper. Every frame is drawn on sheet of paper. And I think audiences are now sophisticated enough that they've seen perfection in Pixar movies, and they're kind of excited to see the craftsmanship. And it's part of the story. It's part of what we're talking about, that you have to keep a certain spontaneity, a certain chaotic, you know, liveliness to things to not like suck all the soul out of them. Like, it seems like the Puritan town, it doesn't really have any soul left in it, especially the soldiers, whereas the people in the forest are full of scratches and stakes and rubbings out and fixes. And that's kind of more lively and more positive in our little story.
Well, I think there's a huge amount of trust in the audience that you might not get in other animated films. That, like, here you've got playing with perspective in terms of like the layout of the town to the forest to the fields in between, and the shapes of houses and how they might fold into each other, and even multi-panel sequences that you might feel come from a comic book. Yeah. And like, none of that actually makes you forget where anything is or anything like that, and it only serves to kind of, I suppose, heighten the experience that you want to give people.
Yeah, I think we were trying out a lot of things in Secret of Kells, you know, because we were straight out of college, and we were trying out a lot of things to see what would be acceptable to the average audience, you know, and if we went too far into abstract, like non-perspective, that people would suddenly be removed from the story. But so I think we tested the waters very well in that first film. There was one film that Tom showed me very early on. What was it? The Tale of the White Mare? Was it
Son of the White Mare?
Son of the White Mare.
Marcel Yankovic.
Yeah. And that goes into complete abstraction. You know, like absolutely mental psychedelic abstraction.
Yeah.
But yet you can still follow the story. So we were thinking, like, well, that's how far you can actually go, and the story can still be told. So, you know, we had a very high benchmark.
I think it's a very naive kind of Western idea that the more like a photograph, a painting is, the better it is. Where actually, I think the only answer to the fact that CG now is like completely invisible, like people don't even realize they're watching CG a lot of the time when they watch a superhero movie. Like, how much of Iron Man is actually Robert Downey Jr. and how much is like a CG model of Iron Man flying around? And so there's nowhere left to go, in my opinion, except to explore all the different directions you can go in. And the fact is that Eastern European animation, some Japanese animation, has really been pushing out into other expressive directions. I saw a Japanese film called The Children of the Sea. Have you seen that? And that just blew my socks off again, because I was like, wow, like, look how brave they are and how far they can push into a really psychedelic or mind game. Like, those movies are really showing that animation is a language in itself. It's not less than live action, and it's good if it looks like live action. Like, that's a crazy way of thinking. I think it's good, the more we use what only animation can do and the braver we are with that, the more the audience kind of, and they're sophisticated now, you know, kids watch all kinds of crazy abstracted cartoons, they play video games, you know, they read comics that are all like all different styles from one panel to the next. So really think you owe to the audience, especially the young audience, to do something up to the level of dynamism that they expect now, you know.
And I think what we can probably bring to that table then is like the use of traditional media, you know, like and explore like the range of what the artists that are in the studio. A lot of them are printmakers and painters, and you know, they work in traditional media. So we can bring a lot of that on board and use that to heighten our storytelling.
But then that's what I think that you do so well with particularly Wolfwalkers and Kells, with the whole Cartoon Saloon thing, is you have that sense of experimentation of the form. Not to bring everything back to Ghibli, but over the course of the series, Jake and I have this. Takahata is the guy who couldn't draw but was an experimenter with the form. Miyazaki could draw, created his own style, but became a great storyteller of these universal fantasy, you know, natural parables that had great universal meanings. You managed to do both in Wolfwalkers. It's incredibly experimental in a way that people might not see, especially for mainstream audiences. But then you do have that core, people will come out crying in the end as well.
I always feel a bit bad for Takata because he kind of made it this badge of honor that he couldn't draw, but he was actually pretty decent, you know. He just chose to hand over to like art directors and people that he felt. Whereas Miyazaki is much more like everyone's kind of an extra wrist, like everyone's an extra hand. To if he could draw it all himself, I think he would, you know. And like he's just like I read his comics, like Nausicaa, and I'm like, how did he draw like this? Like this is a life's work for any cartoonist to draw these like two volume. Telephone book thick comic books in between making like feature films. So yeah, they're two very different kind of geniuses. One was
why Takahata said he couldn't draw because the standard was up so high.
I know, yeah. I remember kind of believing that until I saw the Tale of Princess Kaguya behind the scenes, and I saw his drawings, and I was like, what the hell? He can totally draw, but not to that like amazing level of Miyazaki, but you know, he could make a very clear storyboard. So I think that is interesting. And I think even within the studio, we're not as limited as that. We don't have two founders that are the figureheads that everything has to follow. We've got a really diverse, and what's really interesting is that like Ross and I have been with the studio from the very beginning, Nora as well, but now we're starting to get people like Louise Bagnell coming up, another young director in the studio. And most of our storyboard team were directors, you know, whether it was Guillaume or Louise or Giovanna, like we lots of people that are directors as well, and their voices are starting to come to the fore. So we're not really limited by our own talents. We're kind of we're more like Takahata that we've got the benefit of the talents of all these other people that we can draw on. So I'm excited.
Maybe that's one of the benefits of not going down the whole like master apprentice thing, in that someone who's young and talented can come in, and if they have a great idea, they can immediately just get up and start making it if the studio's behind it. Whereas I think maybe in the Ghibli model, like you have to work your way up the ladder and put in 20 years of experience before you
get to. I think it's the positive side of not especially being a genius. I have to rely on other people. If I was like Miyazaki and I was such a genius, I could do everything myself. It might be painful because you want to do everything yourself. But thankfully, I'm not a genius. So I have to work with all these other people to get my ideas across. And I think that leads to something a bit richer, you know.
So, gents, thank you so much for talking with us. One question that we always ask interviewees when we have guests on the show is, so the kernel of Ghibli Attack started 2.5 years ago when across the desk at work I heard that Jake hadn't seen any Ghibli films. So I sort of grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and said, I'm going to show you all of these films that I love. So now now that we've seen all the Ghibli films, we now need to find out where to go next. So whenever we have guests on, we ask, if you could recommend us a film, it doesn't have to be an animated film, it doesn't have to be feature length, even if there's a Hungarian short you'd recommend us, but could you recommend us something to watch?
Hungarian short, Sisyphus, Marcel Jankovic.
Yeah. I mean, like the Son of the White Mare, you might, as soon as you're going down that road, you might as well watch that, you know.
Do a deep dive into Cold War crazy Hungarian animation. There you go. There you'll really blow your mind.
Excellent. Oh, thanks so much, guys. That's been really lovely to talk to you about the new film, the old films, and of course Studio Ghibli as well.
Lovely to talk to you too, guys.
Thank you again to Ross Stewart and Tom Moore from Cartoon Saloon. They're lending us their time to talk about Wolfwalkers and, of course, the wonderful world of Studio Ghibli, which is something that we're going to be carrying on doing for the next few weeks of this podcast series. If you want to watch Wolfwalkers, you can do so right now. It's in UK cinemas, but it is going to be on demand through Apple TV Plus in December as well.
I must say, I absolutely loved being able to talk to Tom and Ross today. Cartoon Saloon have made some of my favorite films over the last 10 years or so. Song of the Sea is up there as one of my favorite animated films, or films full stop, of all time. And you know, if we were going to venture outside of Ghibli and outside of anime into world animation, looking for studios who have high quality feature film catalogs, you know, Cartoon Saloon might be the one. And I don't know, listeners, if you want to get ahead of us, you can watch their films all over the place. I think The Breadwinner is on Netflix UK, Song of the Sea is on Prime Video UK, and Secret of Kells, I think you can rent or still get on Blu-ray too.
And when travel is a more foreseeable thing, I feel like we could do a micro version of our Japan series, Michael, and just head over the channel and visit the lads.
if you say it on mic, Jake, it has to happen. So this is the first of the Whispers from the Heart mini-series. We have such exciting things coming up. Interviews with people whose work I don't even know. It's been a real eye-opener for me as well. But next week, we are talking with Oscar winner Domi Shee, director behind the Pixar short Bao. We're talking about the influence of Isao Takahata and Ghibli, and also the representation of food in animation.
And beyond that, there's so many wonderful conversations. Steph introduced us to the world of Steven Universe, and that led to a fantastic conversation with Rebecca Sugar.
And speaking of Stevens, we also talk with Steve Alpert, who was the man who brought Ghibli to the world. He was their first head of the international division back in the days when they were selling Princess Mononoke to the States, and was there, was the man in the room when Spirited Away wins all of its awards. A fascinating, incredibly deep dive, nerdy conversation there for the Ghibli diehards, I think.
Yeah, and we might be calling our shot about our guests, but I think we might have at least two films within this series that we focus on that are going to get nominated for the animated feature Oscar, because we're ending the series with Mike Jones, one of the writers of Soul, the upcoming Pixar release that's going to be on demand in December as well.
Yeah, we have a huge lineup, so hopefully you'll stick with us for some great interviews, some great chat. And until then, you can drop us an email if you like. The mailbag is open, ghibli@little.studios.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter @GhibliOtech. And if you want to see what we're up to individually, you can follow Michael @MichaelJLeader.
You can follow Jake @JakeHCunningham.
And you can follow Steph @_StephWatts.
Ghibliotech is a Little Dot Studios production. Our music is made by Anthony Ng, our artwork is by Sophie Moe, and Jamie Maisner is our audio wizard. The show is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Steph Watts, and Harold McShiel.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.